Welcome to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw, where we dive into life lessons from entrepreneurs, experts, leaders, writers, and difference makers. They all have three things in common. None are perfect, all are humble, and they've learned a few things along the way. And What I Wish I Knew, they share those lessons with you. If there's one thing we've learned from guests on the show, it's this. No matter the obstacles, these people always find a way. Please subscribe, follow, and rate us on your favorite podcast platform, and join our email list at whatiwishiknewshow.com. Camilla Barnard believes people should be able to feel good about loving food, not guilty. Her starting point was one of those good-for-you foods that may not taste so good, muesli. Trouble is that muesli is a commodity category dominated by big food companies, famous brands, and basic store products. Few would have the audacity to start there. And yet her company, Root Health, has become a familiar sight on store shelves, shopping baskets, and family kitchens across the UK and Europe. In this episode of What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Daw, Camilla talks about how not knowing can be a strength, how Instagram has changed consumer behavior, and how creativity and attitude often leads to better solutions than expertise alone. Camilla co-founded Root Health in London in 2005 with her husband, Nick. Root Health is on a mission to make the healthy choice a celebration, not a sacrifice, with a range of over 75 foods and drinks, and a team of 45 glass half fullers. As well as being a full-time mom of two, Camilla is the creative brain behind the business's marketing and brand development and is on a mission to inspire everyone to be in Root Health by joyfully challenging the assumption that health food has to be bland and boring. Camilla Barnard, welcome to What I Wish I Knew. And let's start with what got you here.
It's so funny that because it's such a relevant question, but it's also it's such a hindsight question, you know, but at the time, I can now make it sound like a logical or sort of a story that follows a narrative. But at the time, that I could never have told you what the step beyond the next step was. So it's a series of decisions, which with hindsight, enough of which have turned out to be good enough that we're still here and thriving. But at the time, it was just a series of decisions. After I had no idea what I wanted to do. I think I decided I wanted a vineyard at some stage, still haven't done that. And the going into breakfast cereals came about when I just had second child. First child was 18 months old and was just sitting in the garden with a neighbor talking about, you know, things that could be better. And muesli was one of the ones that could be better. I mean, it was bound to revolve around food because my life largely revolves around food. But that was it. It was a chance conversation that you know, was, well, mueslis are pretty rubbish, aren't they? And that was the business plan, was make a better muesli. And it's been, I could talk for about 3 hours on the series of decisions we've made since then, but fundamentally, that was the one that started it. Was, well, surely we could make a better muesli. And it was kind of the perfect thing to start with, because the premise of it, as you sort of alluded to in your intro, is that given that you have to eat and you have to sleep in life, there's pretty much no option on those. You will die if you don't. You're doing pretty well if you love both of them. If you love eating and you love sleeping, I feel like you've nailed the major elements of life. So I totally defend my love of food on that basis. But it also, that then meant when what I really wanted to do was for everybody to love food and to love food in a way that made them feel good and not like guilty or, you know, a failure or worried, which seems to be a big thing. So muesli is about the most extreme, you know, healthy, good for you, zero guilt food. So if we could make that delicious, attractive, then I felt like we'd started at the extreme end and achieved something. I mean, again, though, that's hindsight. At the time, I don't think I would have been that clear about explaining it.
But what experience did you have or bring, Camilla? Because as I described, highly competitive, massive, and ultimately getting into the grocery boys is one of the hardest challenges for any brand.
I think you have to have a degree of ignorance stroke naivety to even go into this. And we didn't, we knew we could make the muesli. We were pretty confident we could make a great muesli. If someone had pushed us on, well, how are you going to get this into a supermarket? I would have just gone, I don't know, absolutely no idea. But we didn't think about that at that stage. We just made the muesli. And we started off at our local delicatessen. This was in 2006 when, you know, premium food economy was flying, organic was flying, premium food was, you know, in demand. Local delicatessen took it. And then next local delicatessen, we just hand sold it, went around selling it. I think it was about a year in, maybe even less, when someone said, I have no idea who it was, but someone said, do you know that 94, 95% of cereals in the UK are sold in the supermarket? And my husband and I went, no, interesting facts. Because of course it was a complete revelation, but it totally, that's pretty fundamental to your business model. Because at that point we were looking at delicatessens and health food shops, not realizing that even if we got 100% distribution, that would be maximum 6% of the total market. So everything was learning. We had fundamentally, we had no idea what we were up against. We didn't know what the challenges we were. We didn't realize that we were a minnow in a field of huge, you know, even if they're not sharks, you know, huge whales, whatever. And that probably was why we did it. And actually that's what you need. Because if you go into it knowing too much, I think you just look at it and go, I can't possibly achieve that.
How did you get that first listing? You know, for everybody listening on, you know, on the show, there's lots of people who launch products, yeah, and you know, you've got to have a degree of inertia, you've got to have scale, you've got to have umpteen, you know, lists of standards, you know, to manufacture and deliver and all the rest of it. How did that come about?
Well, our first supermarket listing was actually, we got into Sainsbury's on the Try Something New program that they ran, which was, as it says, about trying something new. And there are almost always some initiatives going on. They've got a different program now, but Sainsbury's still have a kind of startup program where they try and bridge that gap, because they don't, you know, the reputation of the supermarkets for dealing with small businesses in the UK is not great, but it's not that they're nasty or horrible. It's an inevitable gap between how a huge efficient machine like a supermarket runs and the world of a small business. There's just a gulf, as you said, a mile wide. So on this particular program, they chose some of our light cereals, including our puffed rice, which had one ingredient, which was rice puffed. and that was going to sit on their free from shelves. And we came out of the meeting, you know, when they'd said yes to a few of these cereals, including the puffed rice. And I thought, great, brilliant, job done. Just wait for the email to tell us sort of where to send it to, you know, because we knew no better. And this was really where the kind of balance of myself and my husband came into play. He's much more of a salesperson than a marketing person. And he, you know, followed up and emailed and questioned, and it was like, well, what, great, thanks, what next, when do we get the next email, what happened? And you'd get radio silence, because obviously you're emailing somebody for whom it's no longer their question, and they, so we go back and say, who do I need to ask next? And it was his sort of relentless tenacity that got us from the yes to actually being on shelf. I probably would have, at that stage, probably nothing would have happened. So it was a combination of the having that little program that got us in, and then relentlessly pursuing, what do I do next? Do I need to do something? Is there a pallet? How do we supply this? What information do you, and there was loads, you know, it wasn't just who do we need to speak to, or when do we get an order? Oh, actually there isn't such a thing as an order. You know, when do you give us a number of store listings, and what pallet configuration, and which warehouse? I mean, it was stuff, questions we didn't even know how to ask. And you just had to keep asking any question to get the sense back that that was the wrong question, but there was a question you did need to ask. So you kind of got to be a mind reader. The first one's the worst, though. You quickly kind of get to grips with the whole supermarket protocol thing.
I think it's fascinating, though, Camilla. I mean, we were talking to someone a while back, and he said, you know, I wouldn't have done this if I knew how hard it was going to be. And, you know, you just said essentially sort of that in some ways, ignorance can be a strength, that what we don't know is exactly what doesn't hold us back. Yep. Whereas if we know all of that stuff, I mean, I can tell you, at least from where I sit, having sat in marketing for years, I would never consider starting, you know, a cereal brand, particularly in a category that's dominated by my own brand and entrenched large food companies and having to deal with the grocery channel. And the reason I wouldn't have is because I would have said that's too hard.
You're absolutely right. And I think for me, that is one of the sort, I don't know whether it's an entrepreneur thing or a startup thing, but it's the bit I love is when it's because you've got total ignorance or total naivety, but you've also got a completely blank canvas and it's kind of up to you what you do with it. And it's the stage when it calls on your, you know, whatever it is, your creativity, your resilience, your ideas, your commitment. But it's fundamentally, it's nothing's written down. There's no structure. There's no, as you said, there's no, you just go for something. And for me, that's the bit I love. I mean, it's, yes, it's maximum risk, but it's the most fun by a country mile, as far as I'm concerned. Once it gets to the point where you know what you're doing, it reminds me of writing an essay at school where I loved the working out what was the answer, but you know, that tends to happen in your head and then you write it down. Oh, the amount of times I actually fell asleep over my book as I was writing it down, because I'd done the fun bit, I'd done the thinking. I didn't really want to have to write it down and blow by blow and justify and explain it with quotes and references. And I love the bit where you're working it out and coming up with something. So yeah, and it doesn't matter for that bit whether it's right or wrong or whether you're in a completely ridiculous position and it's impossible. That's the fun bit.
I get the sense though, you touched on you being that fun and creative, and Nick, you know, making sure let's get the order without meeting Nick, but there's definitely a symbiotic relationship, of course it is, but I get the sense you bring two things to the table, well, more than two things, but you bring different skills to it, and that's what makes it work.
I think it has. I mean, we obviously didn't enormously know that at the beginning, but I mean, we're a couple, so we'd obviously worked that there was some kind of relationship that worked there. And yes, it has. I think you're absolutely right. It has absolutely worked in the business when Nick is the more obvious entrepreneur of the two of us. I would say his motivation is making things happen. It's delivery. Whereas I'm more inspired by ideas and creativity and that people and wonder. It's a sort of slightly, but I think together they work really, really well, because it's enabled us to not only make the right food, but have the consumer in mind and build a team that's also inspired. So yeah, absolutely, totally complementary skills, it turns out.
And how do you do that? We interviewed a couple, a few podcasts ago, and they talked about, you know, that it's 24/7, of course, because they're a couple and they have the same business. How do you work together outside of the business? Do you literally take that home? Do you compartmentalize it? Have you worked the habit, you know, of being able to live with both?
It's different. It's a little bit bigger now, isn't it? We're 16 years in and we've got a fantastic team, and it you know, runs very differently from those first few years. Those first few years of 100% startup, where, I mean, Nick and I were doing everything. We knew we might have one other person or two other people. So you're doing absolutely everything. You're doing it around two very small children. So it is 24 hours. So everything was children or rude health for quite a long time. It was, and a lot of it was at home. So and Nick always has this saying that work is fun and fun is work. And what he means is it, why would you not do it? Because actually that's it's fun and it should be fun. So there wasn't any sort of idea of leaving it at home. I mean, it is incredibly intense. And I have to say, it is like a third child. And it's now reached that stage where it's a maturing teenager. And what it needs from me and Nick is very different from what it needed at the beginning, which again is fun because it means it changes. But yeah, it's no, if anybody who manages to sort of do it part-time for the first few years, I would love to know how they're doing that, because it is all consuming. It just needs constant thought and constant change and a million things, you know, you can't even do half of them.
So maybe you could put it in context. I mean, maybe share with us a little bit about, you know, what was Rude Health when you first started? You talked about starting a muesli, but what is your vision now and how has that changed through the years?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I mean, when it started, that, you know, we just wanted to make a great muesli and then some great cereals, and it was barely even the back of an envelope. You know, it was let's just do it. We had a couple of really fun years where we just played from 2006 to 2008, which I now look at almost as live research. Like, somebody who'd come into this as a planning person could have done more or less what we did on paper, but we just did it and learned. So we did a huge, we started with £4,000, and that bought the ingredients, the tubs that we put the muesli in, and the labels, and some aprons. And the aprons were for going out and doing in-store tastings, which were for sales, obviously, but also market research, marketing, everything. That was all we did. So all our learnings came from what our consumers were saying to us, you know, and also looking in their baskets, looking at who they were, looking at what they wore. You know, it was a total picture just from doing some tastings. And that kept leading us on and leading us on. But that was, you know, that was it at the beginning. It was very personal, very intuitive. Nick moved on very quickly. So we did cereals for a couple of years, 2006, 2008, all learning, all mopping it up by getting out there and doing it. 2008, the economy crashed, and being a premium food startup was not a great position to be in, especially as at the beginning of the year we'd decided to raise our game and professionalize and get into the supermarkets, as we've, you know, talked about earlier. We realized that if we wanted to do this properly, it was absolutely essential. So after September 2008, supermarkets were scrambling around creating value ranges, not taking on brand new premium mueslis at £5 for 500 grams. So we then clung on by the skin of our teeth for a couple of years, you know, blind faith and absolute determination. That was the real, I mean, that was a proper test of, are you really in this? Are you really going to do this? Is this a game, or are you actually serious? And that was we really believe we've got something here. We've just got to stick and stand by it. And actually we used that to combination of focus and diversify. So total focus, and you didn't spend 3p without thinking about it. Every single spend was considered, every penny, and at the same time, we look beyond cereals to, is there anything else we could be doing using our understanding and increasing knowledge of grains, in particular oats? So we branched out into rice crackers, which are just the Italian version, which are thinner and crispier than the rice crackers we normally had. We branched out into oat cakes, which is a Scottish tradition. And we used oatmeal and olive oil and improved the ingredients. So we started to work out what worked, and in categories that were slightly less competitive and, you know, enabled us to just keep things moving and get some listings. And then the big break came actually in 2013 when we launched the dairy-free drinks. And at the time, it was just another launch as far as we wanted to say just. I mean, we loved the launches. We loved the new foods. But we didn't realize it was. We honestly didn't know it was going to be a game changer. And that, you know, now in 2021, that it would be 70% of our business.
Wow.
So what happened at the time was, you know, we're excited about what should we do next? What, you know, what's happening? What's new? What's interesting? What could we, which category could we bring something to? And while I'm out there in the stores in doing tastings, you know, saying, would you like some of my lovely granola? And more and more customers, not loads, but more than before, would say, oh, yes, I'd love to try it. But have you got anything that isn't dairy, isn't milk, or isn't yogurt? And it was just noticeably not only the people who were allergic to milk or vegan. It was becoming a little bit more, a little bit less rare. It would happen at every tasting. So it nudged us into thinking, oh, that's interesting. Dairy-free seems to be a thing. And actually what's in that, I mean, it was so depressing when somebody did ask that, because then I'd have to put some really rather ugly, gritty, horrible ingredient drink thing onto my very amazing, delicious, ultimate granola, you know, made with all these fabulous ingredients. And I think, no, you've just drowned my amazing granola. And so I'd quite often say, you could have it dry. So it did seem like there was a gap at the time of a quality dairy-free milk. And so Nick's mission was to go and find one, a quality one that ticked all our boxes, because it had to taste better. The ingredients had to be better than what was out there. And then my job was to make it look better and make it appeal to people more. So that was what we did, but we had no idea that it was going to be more or less the next big trend when we did it, and our timing was absolutely right. And from then on, you know, from launch in 2013 in Waitrose, they've grown and grown and grown. As you know, the whole market's just unstoppable.
Yeah, it's blossomed. So if we think about the show, which is the What I Wish I Knew, and you've already alluded to a number, talking about listening to the voice of the customer or the consumer, what else is there? What's your headline stuff that you would say, hey, these are the things as an entrepreneur, if you're starting out a business, just think of these things either. And I know you and I have spoke about the kind of internal piece, you know, about the people that work for you, but then also the external piece.
I think when I started, as we were completely new to making food, full stop, as a business thing, fundamentally new to consumer marketing, and you know, the whole running a production business being a brand holder was a whole new thing for us. I tended to assume that whenever we spoke to somebody, that they would be an expert, you know, whether that was a supermarket buyer or somebody's, persuading us to do experiential marketing, or it didn't matter who it was, but I would assume immediately that they would have incredible knowledge that I wouldn't have because we were new. And I think what I've gradually realized over the years is that is a really, really bad assumption. And they might do, but don't start from that position. Do not start from that place. Because, I mean, in the case of the supermarket buyer, they move them around every 18 months. So the person you're speaking to could have been buying frozen chicken yesterday. They might know nothing about cereals. Also, their world revolves around what they sell on shelf in the next sort of quarter, 3 months. So their view is so short term. I mean, by necessity, isn't that in order to do a good job in their window of 12, 18 months, they're looking at the next three. So what you can bring to that, you know, is enormous that they will never, it's not in their interest to know. They haven't got the time to know it. So yes, you know, I might not know about the supermarket and how that works, but my goodness, I know a whole lot more about cereals and what goes into them, what's important, what consumers want. So, I mean, that's just one tiny example. But I think the sort of confidence of your convictions or courage that what you believe, you may well actually be right, and that the person you're talking to will have expertise, but not necessarily the expertise you've got. Yeah, that would be, for me, that would be the worth learning. Trust yourself. If you really feel it, if you really believe it, then there's no reason anyone else knows any better than you do.
That's incredible. And with the development of the brand, you know, I talked about, and maybe there's more than 60 products now. I think that's what I read on your website. But how and why have you gone internationally so quickly? Because as a marketer, Mike and I would probably say, hey, you know, baby steps, build a brand, you know, develop the core, do all the kind of marketing DNA, and then go into a market and try another one. But it seems like you've just got, hey, this is a great product, bang. Just help us understand that.
Well, I think you're probably right. And I think what happened was somebody came to us. So certainly in food, what tends to happen is a couple of times a year, international, you know, buyers, distributors come to the UK to see what's going on. And they do pretty much the same tour. They go to one of these small independent food shows, and they go to Whole Foods Market, they go to Selfridges, this is where you see all the new stuff, and they'll go to a Waitrose to see what's filtered through to the supermarket that tends to take the new stuff first, and then they go to the brand who they've seen to go, oh, would you like to be in Norway? And we went, hell yeah, would be great. Why not? And this was really, really early on. And So again, you know, there wasn't a business plan. There was no focusing on the core or any of the things that you should do. But it just seemed like a great opportunity. So what we've done ever since then, through sort of serendipity rather than a strategy, was when we find either a retailer or a distributor or a person, you know, on the ground who knows their market and completely resonates with what we're trying to do, who can effectively be the voice of the brand, and if they want to look after it in their market, then that's our sort of, okay, great, you have a look, you know, you look after it in your market. And it's all very small scale, well, almost all very small scale. There's a couple of markets, surprising ones, for example, Portugal, where it's a much more significant, we've got a partnership with their biggest retailer. But it's a lovely way of testing markets. It's a lovely way of just getting out there more, finding out the differences, seeing how things work, and just being able to develop it sort of slowly without taking your eye off the core, basically. You know, we haven't invested an enormous amount abroad, but it does, it's fun. And you get the feedback, you find out what works and what doesn't.
So Camilla, I'm still intrigued on how you would manage that. You know, you've got umpteen markets pulling you. And Mike and I have worked with brands around the world where distributors may or may not do the things you tell them or you want them to do. And for those listening, you know, there are brand owners. How do you do that successfully?
The only thing I can think is that it's choosing the right distributor, and that you've got to feel that they get it and allow them, fundamentally let them to make the choices within their market, because the markets operate so differently that, you know, if we put a set of rules on what kind of shops you could be in or something like that, it wouldn't work, because, you know, our sort of division, the UK division of, you know, health food shops, supermarkets, you know, farm shops, whatever, doesn't exist somewhere else. So I don't know how you would codify sort of what you want them to do. And because they're relatively small scale, you know, there was no sort of requirement to achieve vast numbers. It was just making it work fundamentally for everybody so that everybody's not losing money out of it. You know, they could choose whether they wanted to start top down, which is, you know, often the way they might start in the health food stores and build, and then they might after a while get a supermarket listing. That's kind of how it's worked in, say, Switzerland, where we've now got supermarket listings, but we've been there for what, 8-10 years, so no rush from our part, just gradually build a brand, and it may work and it may not. Netherlands, we put some, you know, there was someone on the ground who we just couldn't resist hiring, so we set up a little office out there, and they look after, I mean, they now actually head up international from out there and look after everywhere. And then your Portugal, that was a, you know, bang straight into partnership with the biggest retailer. But it's finding the partners who you trust to know what they're doing in their area. I suppose very much like employees, and you want to find, well, in a young business, you know, you want to find people who want to look after their own bit, and then we leave them to it, sort of.
So kind of along those lines, and who is the customer here? Who are you going after? And does that vary internationally, or is it changing even within the UK?
That's a really interesting one, because it totally changed in the UK around about 2013 when we launched the Out Milks. So the customer before then was, I would say, more of the mother looking after her family and herself profile. Much more traditional sort of approach, as like premium shopper, you know, wanting the good food for themselves and for their family at that stage in life where you've got a little bit more time, a little bit more money, and you're more concerned about health. And then in 2013, we launched the Out Milks, and Instagram happened, coincidentally at the same time. But what Instagram did was actually shift, I don't know whether it did it or whether it would have happened anyway, chicken and egg, but it completely shifted in the UK the relationship between health and food. So until that point, beauty had nothing to do with food whatsoever, more or less, and health had sort of two routes. You either had the sort of, you you had like inner health, which was all bran and health and misery. You know, it was like, you eat this because you have to, you know, which was the thing we were sort of trying to fight against. But then outer health was entirely looking good. You know, it was entirely about diet. It was just lose weight. It was basically eat as little as you can and lose weight. So there was, and this was, I mean, what was exciting was this was sort of what we'd wanted to fix right from the beginning, was this is complete madness. This is no way to live. And what Instagram bizarrely managed to sort of bring together was the idea that what you eat actually has a huge impact on, you know, how you are, how well you are, which in turn goes on to sort of how you look. So now I can't remember the question. So yes, so the customer changed. So at that point, and that appeal, that whole world brought in a much, much, much younger consumer. So that at that point, we were suddenly appealing to, you know, people in their sort of urban Londoners in particular, Londoners who were fitness oriented and had a really sort of, I can do this view on life. And so they would be doing yoga, they would be having green smoothies, you know, and wanting to eat something that was genuinely good for them. But that also fit with their kind of upbeat lifestyle. And that was really what helped us to bring the brand together. And we'd done a bit of piece of work on how to resonate, what was our, you know, our message and our energy. And it was that sense of what we really, where we resonate with people is when they are, well, they want to be in rude health, which is an old English expression, meaning sort of up for life and bursting with energy. So it was at that stage that we kind of nailed the attitudinal bit rather than a particular demographic. I mean, obviously there's a demographic because our stuff, unfortunately, costs us more to make and then costs more to buy. But fundamentally, you're buying into this idea of health that's fun, you know, and that's what you want. It's like we call it the glass half fuller approach to life. And those are the people who... I think resonate with what we do, and that's who we're appealing to. But it is now, in terms of demographically, it's a bit of a broad church, which doesn't make it very easy to target, but hey, more people the better. I don't know.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating. And I'm guessing there were effects. What has been the effects over the last 12 or 18 months as, you know, obviously COVID, but the lockdowns and linked to that, people's awareness of themselves. What's happened to you and your brand?
Well, I think the hardest thing for us has been that we've been very much a connection and relationship brand. So our marketing has been very, very, very small scale. We have never done an above the line campaign. We have done lots and lots and lots of small events, tastings, dinners, breakfasts, you know, out and about, you know, swimming, all kinds of events with people, and that's not been possible. So our entire, you know, when lockdown happened in March 2020, you know, our entire marketing calendar effectively just got wiped. There was nothing on it that we could do, which was, you know, interesting. We worked around it. We came up with a whole pile of different things, but it's a very different way of doing business. And when you can't actually interact, you can't meet your possible consumer, you can't talk to them, you can't engage with them, there's no they don't get any sense of energy or vibe, you know, all they're going to get is something on a screen or on a poster. Well, actually they weren't even going to get that last year because nobody was outside, you know, nobody was on anyway where you would even see a poster. So it was that for me was the biggest challenge, and equally so that was the sort of reaching the consumer when what we want is that level of connection. And actually the same in working with people, where, you know, being able to do video calls is an absolute lifesaver, but at the same time it is not the same as an actual conversation in a room with someone. It's just different, and you don't get the same level of connection, and particularly if you're doing sort of ideas, you know, creativity stuff, it's not the same. So there's been a consumer challenge and also a getting together with your coworkers challenge.
I wonder though too if you know, the heightened sense of health, but also just people adapting to a newer way or a different ways of communicating, do you feel like any of that will continue to roll forward in your business or in your category?
God, I certainly hope so. I hope we get something out of this. But yeah, no, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. It's moved on enormously, the ability to do video calls. And I think we will waste a lot less time traveling. I think we will, being able to travel and see whether it's suppliers or customers again will be fantastic. But I think we'll be able to do a whole lot more in between, which is more functional, rather than just email or go. I think that will be brilliant in terms of long distance communication. And yeah, it doesn't have to be long distance. So I do think that will move it along. And I hope that it's made a lasting impression on, you know, people's health. Although I did read the other day that generally people have gained weight over lockdown, which wasn't enormously encouraging. But perhaps that will turn into a new focus on, you know, looking after ourselves afterwards. I don't know. I think there was a lot of comfort eating to deal with the, you know, with the difficulty of a change of circumstances, and there wasn't much else to do. I'm not quite sure in terms of eating and healthy habits or attitudes what the shift will be, but I think it's going to be fascinating to watch that unravel over the next few months.
Yeah,
I wonder sometimes if to some extent, you know, it'll have the reverse effect, that the people that were very disciplined before, regular gym goers and the like, were sort of forced away from their regular habits and into things that were less maybe healthy. And people that weren't quite as healthy are like, oh, wait a minute, now I need to actually, you know, pay attention to myself and what I eat, or, you know, what my family eats. And almost as if sort of this shift might be less good for some and really good for others.
Yeah. And it might not be the ones that you think of, you know, it might be, as you say, it might be the ones that you weren't expecting. How did that change work? Because for a lot of people, there was more time. I mean, I found, because my children are teenagers, the homeschooling wasn't such a big deal for me, you know, it wasn't a major engagement problem. And I had loads more time because I'm not driving around. I was not doing all that driving around. The scheduling went out of my day. So that for me was an absolute gift for the first bit, especially as the weather was good. But, you know, for the people with young children who were trying to work and homeschool, I mean, I imagine anybody who didn't drink more wine and buy more instant food, I think would, you know, I would give them some kind of superstar medal. I mean, how? Just from not enough hours in the day and extraordinarily stretched. So, yeah, it will have had very different impacts on people in different circumstances, I think. And I'm not sure that the full impact will become clear for a few years, because it's been, and for teenagers and things, I think it's probably actually been quite an extraordinarily weird growing up process, and not, because teenagers are social creatures, that is the time in your life when you make mm-hmm. your connections and start to be you in the world, and to remove that is we've never done that before. That's an experiment. Yeah. See what outcome, what impact that has on a generation. Who knows?
No, it's interesting. Really interesting. And at the same time, you talked about, you know, you guys being on Zoom calls and interacting, etc. Or how did you come about in terms of getting your B Corp and accreditation there? Because it's a fabulous accreditation to have. Was that something came up during the COVID? It was something planned years ago, etc.
Yeah, really interesting one. We've actually pretty much always run the business on the sort of B Corp principles, that, you know, you're trying to do, make good food that's good for the planet and in a way that's great for the employees. So we fundamentally, it was pretty much embedded in the business anyway, but that was just because that was what Nick and I believed in, and it wasn't sort of written down or codified anywhere or anything. And what happened, I think you know, lockdown did probably push that more, because communication is harder and people are going to pick up less information. That picking up of general information goes when you're not in the same room. And the desire for the B Corp status really came from the team, and then was supported by the management team. Thought this was wonderful that the team was so excited and engaged about the opportunity. And then the team actually drove it through and made it happen. They set up a little group, cross sort of functional group, who worked with the B Corp organization to create all of the documentation and answer all of the questions that they needed, just checking in with the management team whenever they needed to, wouldn't you? A bit of support and guidance. But what was really lovely was that was a totally team-led certification. They were inspired by it, they wanted to do it, and they did it. And they did it in good time and with a great score. So yeah, I mean, you know, huge credit to them. It was a real, and it was, and I hope that they got satisfaction out of that, knowing that that's something that they made happen as well.
So Camilla, you've been on this amazing journey, and what would be your advice to someone who maybe is at the front end where they think they may want to do something in the future, but they're really not sure? I mean, maybe if, you know, think about your own kids. What would you tell them about, you know, about a journey like this? I mean, without them necessarily saying, well, hey, I want to start this business that does this. If they don't have that sense of idea, but they want that kind of fulfillment and that kind of impact that you and Nick are having, what do you say?
I'd say if you don't have an idea or you don't have a business in mind, but you think you want to do one, maybe work in a startup and just see, does it, you know, do you like the environment? Do you like that whole phase? And then if you have an idea, because you don't have to know when you have that idea, you've got to believe in it. You know, you've got to think this is actually a great idea. But I think what can happen is that you have to think that idea is like the idea that will change the world forever. And actually, it just has to be a good idea. It just, you know, if you think that your notebook is a more excitable design, or, you know, better shape or something than everyone else's notebook, or you've just got some great quotes you can write on the front or something, that's an idea. You know, it doesn't have to revolutionize notebooks completely. You know, it can be much smaller, I think, than and maybe next year you might change your mind, and that's okay too. So you don't have to feel like you've committed the rest of your life to it. It might work, it might not. But would you be happier having tried it, even if it doesn't succeed? I think that's the sort of, you know, in the end, if Rood Health hadn't worked at all, then I don't think I would have regretted doing it. I think I would have thought, well, I've learned a lot and it didn't work. But if that's if I hadn't done it, I think, you know, I would have wished I had done something.
No, if I walked around your office and spoke to the people that work for you, what kind of sense would I get of them in your environment? Because in a sense, I still get this passion that you have and drive and a dynamism. What's the teams around you, and what would the real culture be behind there, Camilla? So if you were out of the room, what have you been told, or what would you get the sense of?
You can't ask me that question. You have to ask them that question. I have no idea what they do when I'm not in the room. What I would like is that everybody brings themselves to work, because I think I would. So I don't want it to be, you know, in my image. I think it should be people being themselves and bringing themselves to work, because that's when you get genuine. You get genuine input and genuine, you know, thoughts and ideas coming from who someone is rather than who they think they should be in a particular environment. I think it's much richer, much more dynamic, much more, you know, productive in a good way. So that's what I would like the culture to be. And very much because you're always doing something new and different, it should be learning, not blame. You know, you try it and it works or it doesn't, and you try not to make the same mistake again next time. But it's not about not making mistakes. It's just try and keep making different ones in the kind of move on. Not the same one's a problem, but new mistakes is okay. It's fine. It's going to happen.
Yeah. And in your business model, you know, I guess we asked you the question earlier, but what do you see as next? You know, I can kind of translate. You've got international, you've got new innovation, I'm sure. Colloquially or closer to home, you've got Brexit and probably international challenges there as well. What's your kind of, you know, next two to 3 years, without giving the whole game away, but what's your next 2 or 3 years? Where's Camilla and Nick and the team going to spend their time?
sort of in the next 2 to 3 years, I think what we really want to do is use the confidence that we now have in what we make and how good it is, and get it out there. So, as you know, I was saying before, we've never really spent any money on marketing, and actually that's our next thing. We are going to do an above the line campaign in September. One, so that's a whole new stretch for us, beginning of a new era. And the other thing is taking our sort of number one selling product, which is the almond drink. We want that to be available in, you know, pretty much every single store it could be available in the UK. And it isn't at the moment. So it's a relatively straightforward job in that sense. It sounds very clear, but it's not as obviously delivering. It won't be that simple. But yeah, make the almond drink as available as we think it should be. And that's going to involve distribution and marketing. As a whole load of other things, but that's the obvious big one.
Well, sounds so simple.
I know. Yeah, that's it, done.
So I wanted to ask you, you've mentioned before that you see yourself as an adventurer rather than an entrepreneur. Can you explain?
I think in my head, an entrepreneur would probably have a series of businesses, like they almost can't help setting up businesses. Whereas I think probably, you know, if I leave Rude Health at some point one day, I don't see myself doing another business. I'd probably go and do something completely different. I feel like I would have done setting up and creating and building a business to a certain point, and now I would go and do something else that would probably, again, be something I haven't done before. It could, but not, I mean, you know, I might renovate a house or I don't know, you know, just something totally different. So I don't think I'm going to do repeat of the business thing. I think that's the real, for me, that may not even be the right call, but that's what I'm basing it on.
That's fascinating. Well, Camilla, I just want to thank you for your time on the podcast show. I read, I think, on your web or somewhere, you talked about the muesli and making sure it was face-meltingly delicious. And I think there's no better sort of marketing phrase to people like Mike and I that gets you salivating. I've been fortunate enough to try your products, and they're exceptional. I've absolutely been delighted to speak with you today and understand about, A, how you got the success, how you ventured along the way, how you work together as a team, and wish you every success for the future. Can't wait to see the new products, can't wait to see the advertising and what's next in the Rude Health world.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for talking to me. And so I hope your listeners enjoy it, and keep an eye out for Rude Health Almond Drink in a store near you.
Well, I hope that ends up being somewhere in a store in the US as well, so that we can buy it here as well. But, you know, a couple of things that I really take away from this. One of them, you talked earlier about, you know, when ignorance can be a strength, that sometimes knowing too much can cause people to hold back. And I think there's so much value in that. But I think the other thing too, that really rings through this conversation, and I think the whole theme and your success with Rude Health is a sense of audacity, you know, the willingness to actually do things. And I swear, I think about what the listeners might take away from that. And if they take away, you know, at times the value of ignorance, the value of not knowing everything, but then coupled with the audacity to try, is a wonderful combination. So thanks so much for your time and your insight.
No, thank you. Thank you. And yeah, I hope it does inspire people to start their own thing, set something up, make it happen.
We do hope you enjoyed this podcast. And thanks for listening to What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr. Please join us at whatiwishiknewshow.com. You can subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Please share What I Wish I Knew with Mike Irwin and Simon Dorr with your friends. We welcome your feedback and recommendations of new podcast guests and ideas on topics. If you have business challenges, we're also available for advisory and consulting roles. We'd be delighted to listen and help. Just send us an email. Our address is hello@whatiwishiknewshow.com.